Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
And good morning. My name is Dave Kibikian.
And good morning. I'm Jane Marie Schaefer.
Good morning, Jane Marie. Jim Marie and I are two of the attorneys at the Herzog Law Firm, and we are here every weekend talking to you about things like estate planning and elder law and what goes into all those two very broad topics, as well as other related topics, real estate, sometimes matrimonial law, and so on. We have offices in Albany, Kingston, Saratoga Springs, and somewhere in the middle there in Clifton Park. And we'd love to have you be one of our first callers by calling the radio station at 518-476-5900. If you don't want to be on the radio and you just want to come in or ask us a question offline, you could always call our office at 518-465-7581. Jay Marie, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, Ben and I were saying we're cold.
We are. We're cold.
We're cold.
It is pretty cold out this morning. Although I'm sure your kids are going to enjoy the snow.
No snowmen. The snow isn't the best for snowmen. It's a little powdery.
Mm-hmm. That's true. But maybe good for sledding.
I think so. We went sledding yesterday, and then it got extremely cold extremely quickly. And it really, Ben was talking about it before we started. The wind is what gets you. It was extremely freezing.
Yes, the wind is very strong. I can hear it outside. But I'm staying nice and cozy.
Yeah. Well, Alex was tasting the snow. He had no interest in sledding. He was just drinking piles of snow, which is, we gotta work on that one. And Jackie had at it. She was sledding all over the place. It was fun.
That's fun. I remember when my kids used to eat the snow. Just don't eat the yellow snow.
Yeah, that's right. Come on, Jamie. So, we were just saying, Law and Order is coming back. It's back. Law and Order, right? Like, McCoy, the prosecutor, and Lenny Briscoe, one of the best characters of all time on TV. I'm very excited about Law and Order. I think I've probably watched every single episode of the original Law and Order.
Yeah, I would say I probably have. I love that. It's great.
It was like in syndication, so when I was in law school and stuff. So, on TNT, I'm pretty sure I've seen everything about that show. One of the things I loved about it, to kind of bring it in here, is that they would always do like ripped from the headlines, and they'd have their own version of fact patterns that were, maybe it was something like the Astors, or it would be something like, some salacious, murder mystery type thing that the New York Post always would write about. But I was thinking, because so many of our topics that we talk about on the weekend are essentially from our client meetings, that we're basically ripping stuff from the headlines as well. I think Law and Order is a good comp for us.
That's true. But as is so often, the stories that our clients have are, pretty familiar, and many other families have situations that are the same. So it's good to tell those stories so you can see how it relates to you.
Yeah. So I have a number of ripped from the headlines. If you want to choose, you can choose A, B, C, or D, Jay Marie, and we'll kind of start at it. But I would like the listeners to know that the point of this program is for you guys to call and ask questions. So again, 518-476-5900. We'd love to hear from you and help you this cold Saturday morning. So what do you say, Jamie? Would you like A, B, C, or D?
I will go with C.
C. All right. So there are times, Jamie, where a trust, particularly a Medicaid trust, doesn't make the most sense for clients. And one of the really important things that I think you and Harry and myself always try to make sure clients understand is that the rules around Medicaid, the rules regarding long-term care, are very specific and unique. and every fact pattern is different. Mm-hmm. And so as an example, Jay Marie, if I asked you, how much money can I have to qualify for, you know, the Medicaid program when it comes to a nursing home, the amount of resources I could have would be
$16,800.
Yeah. And right. Great. So I can't have more than $16,800 of assets. Well, no, that's not what you said. It was about resources. So the next question would be, well, what does Medicaid consider to be a resource? Right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And in your webinars that you do, I know that almost all of them have slides. Whenever we're talking about Medicaid and we show that slide with the $16,800 and then the income figure, the very mm-hmm. next slide, I think, on every one of our presentations is all about what is considered a resource and what is not. So mm-hmm. do you mind filling people in on the types of things that are resources and the types of things that are not, and then I'll kind of sprinkle in this rip from the headlines fact pattern.
Sure, yeah. The first thing I say when I show that slide after I have the numbers is don't be concerned, right? Because you're probably going to have more money than that. But there are exemptions. And two of the largest exemptions are your house and a retirement plan. But there's little caveats to both. But in general, focusing on the retirement plans, you know, most people come in and say, oh, I have, you know, like $200,000 in investments. I'm not going to qualify. And some people don't get the difference between investments in a retirement plan. And then when you talk and find out a little bit, is it an IRA? That's good news, because the part that's an IRA is going to be exempt from Medicaid. It's only the part that's not an IRA counts.
Jay Marie, Dave, we do have a caller. We have Joanne from Voorheesville.
Morning, Joanne.
Good morning. I am the power of attorney for my sister, whose cognitive abilities are declining. Okay. They have declined to the point where her long-term care policy is now being activated based on that. My question is very simple. Sooner or later, I'm going to have to start signing checks and deposits. How do I sign them as a power of attorney, or should I be moving them into a joint checking account?
This is a great question. So do you have the power of attorney in front of you by any chance?
No, I don't.
Okay. Did you sign the power of attorney? You yourself as an agent? Okay.
Yes, I did.
So that tells, on the line of this whole law and order thing, that tells us, forensics here, that tells Jay Marie and I that the type of power of attorney that was signed was one that was in the last 11, 12 years, and because you had to sign it, right? And part of that power of attorney, the page right before your signature is section N, and it talks about your job, and it says you're not supposed to commingle assets, you're not supposed to do things that are a conflict of interest, you should keep a record when you use it. And number five on that list, and I know it by heart because this is New York State statute saying this disclosure needs to be in the document, number five tells you exactly how to sign. The statute for the power of attorney says that you need to identify your relationship as a agent as well as identify the person you're agent for. And the way that they suggest in the power of attorney is that you would write your sister's name printed, or you could, you know, sign it, but really printed, by, and then you sign your name, as you normally would, comma, POA, or comma, agent, or something like that. Now, if you're going to be doing this for the long haul, I like where your head's at, because you could add your name to a bank account solely as a power of attorney, but that authority would end upon your sister's death, because that's when the power of attorney ends. You could leave the account just in your sister's name and continue to, you know, walk around with that power of attorney in your pocket so you could use it. Or I like option three, which you brought up, which is adding your name to the account as a person, maybe for convenience purposes or maybe be silent on that. But the whole idea would be that you can continue to sign checks because now you're on the account, as well as one day when your sister passes, if you survived her, we avoid probate with that money. which would be a, you know, making lemonade out of lemons.
Are there different types of joint checking accounts? Because I think one of her banks might have already done that. We did file the power of attorney papers with the banks, so they have that on record already.
So they may have added you as power of attorney if they have a copy on record. And that's good and well, but it's important to realize that once the life that the power of attorney is on ends, your authority ends. And so no one will access that bank account money unless there's some sort of surrogate's court action. If there is no rights of survivorship on a joint account, or if you're like a, you know, in trust for or a transfer on death beneficiary of the account. So the question is not really how do you use the power of attorney that I want you to think about, but how does it all end as well? So what's the most right. efficient way for this fact pattern to end?
So there are different terms you use there. There's the a joint owner and okay. something else.
So there's a lot of bank accounts where, like, for example, I know just from experience in dealing with them that, like, as an example, KeyBank is a bank where if two names are on the account, their default way of stating the account is that there's something called rights of survivorship. If one person dies, the money belongs to the other person. Okay, it used to be that there was a signature card, a physical signature card at the bank, and if you were going to have someone on the account with you, they would sign, and if it was your account, you could check a box that said with rights of survivorship. So you had to, like, actively say, someone's going to get this money when I die. But okay. more and more banks are having it automatically like that. So it may be that just adding your name as a person, not as an agent, but as a person to the account, maybe all you need to do. It may be that your power of attorney doesn't allow you to do it, and your sister has to go to the bank to make that change. There will also need to be a box that would say it's for convenience purposes, because she doesn't want you to have the money one day. She wants someone else to have the money. But during her life, it's for convenience purposes. She wants you to be an active signer on that account. So lots okay. of different options.
Okay. So I'll go talk to one of the banks. Is there any liability on my part of making them just an outright joint account?
I don't know if liability is the right word. I mean, part of your job as a agent is to make sure that your sister's estate plan is followed through with as well. When she's unable to tell you what to do and you're trying to act in what's in her best interest, a lot of times her best interest will be to continue her plan. So as an example, if she wanted to leave everything to Jane Marie here, and that's what her will says, and you are now reprogramming all of her assets so nothing ever gets to her will and everything just goes to you, that someone can argue that's not in her best interest. So you just want to be careful there. But besides that, I think you have a lot of discretion.
Okay. So I don't have any taxable interest and all that stuff still goes on her tax records, not mine.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you become a co-owner and that bank account, you know, earned 5 cents of interest, theoretically, some of that interest is now yours because you're a joint account owner. But I'm not worried about the interest coming from the bank these days.
Well, that unfortunately is true, but fortunately, she has a lot of money. Okay, so that's good. Okay, I guess that's it. I print her name, I sign my name with power of attorney. That was the original question. Okay. Thank you very
much. Thanks so much for your call. Thank you.
Okay. Perfect.
Jamie, is there anything you would have added there? Anything I missed?
No, but that, it raises some issues that I was thinking about, some cases that I've had recently. And one is the idea of a convenience account, and that's actually, we're litigating that in one of the estates that I have. It's a concept that if you put someone's name jointly on the account, is it just like what you were talking about so she can pay the bills, or is it really intended to make that person the joint owner so they get the money when that person dies? And, it can go, you have to bring evidence to show which way it's going to go. You know, you look at the signature card, you look at the intent, you look at the estate plan. It's heavily contested, let me put it that way, because a lot of our clients have one of their children joint so they can pay the bills. And everyone in the family says, sure, that's what we understand. It's just to pay the bills. But then every once in a while, someone says, oh, no, now that money's all mine. You know, they see how much is there. It's joint. It goes to me, so I don't have to give it to my siblings. So we've had people on both sides of that issue.
Exactly. And it's kind of like understood, because the purpose of adding, you know, like if you have four kids and you add the, you know, the one that lives local to your bank account, usually it's exactly as you said, to just help out. Right. And the understanding is that that money will avoid probate because there's a co-owner. And then the understanding continues. Okay, daughter, you're the only one on this account. You're going to share with your siblings, or that account is going to be the one that is used, no questions asked, to pay funeral expenses, to pay for all the final things that need to happen. And that's all good and well until there's a misunderstanding or a fight. And now, you know, because a convenience account is supposed to be part of the estate. It doesn't avoid probate if you didn't actually intend it to go somewhere upon your death, technically. So we like it when it is not a convenience account, as long as everybody plays nice afterwards. No guarantees on that.
There's no guarantees on everything, right? And I would say the majority of the cases, it's a convenience account. That sibling will then, as you said, pay the bills and then split it with the other beneficiaries. Or they'll take that money and put it in the estate account, right, to be split among the beneficiaries. But there are those cases where, you know, the sibling, and often it's the sibling who was the caregiver for the parent, you know, and their argument is that I was the caregiver, so mom wanted me to have this money to pay me, you know, or, you know, benefit me for helping to take care of her. And that's their argument for keeping that money in a separate account. Now, it's hard to prove that, what mom's intention was, right, unless she put something in writing that says that, which doesn't often happen.
And that's why those signature cards used to be so valuable, because it would be obviously, you know, a signature so they can compare it to make sure that, you know, a check was endorsed correctly or something like that. But also you used to check the bot. You had to actively do something to say it's with rights of survivorship. And I remember I had a case many, many years ago, and as I mentioned, it happened to be Key Bank was the bank account, and that was the first time I saw where the bank itself had a default of it's automatically with survivorship unless you say otherwise. And that flipped at some point, because all the case law used to be that it's not enough that it's a joint bank account. There had to be more.
That's right. The other thing that I thought of when she was talking, I've only seen bank accounts until recently that were joint with right of survivorship. But we had a client come in, and it was a bank account, and the bank was saying that it was held as tenants in common. So tenants in common means that each person on the account owns their half separately. So they, because it was, the bank was saying tenants in common, and one of the people died, that half didn't automatically go to the joint person. It had to go to probate. And that's really unusual. You know, most joint bank accounts go to the survivor and avoid probate. And in fact, that's what the family thought. They had no idea until they tried to close out the accounts that it was held as tenants in common.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very, you know, the words matter, obviously. And what we would like is that we plan for everyone to play nice, but we also encourage planning based on the fact that people maybe won't play nice after you're no longer here. Prior to the call, Jamie, you were going into what are considered resources and what are not resources for purposes of that $16,800 threshold for qualifying for Medicaid from a quote-unquote asset standpoint. And so not all assets are considered resources here. And you mentioned, you know, retirement. And so that brings me, I'm going to jump in on this rip from the headlines. He's a radio listener. He might be listening right now. And if he is, good morning. So came in and has some money, money that he wants to protect. And the portfolio is heavy into retirement assets. There's no real estate that's owned. There's an apartment that's rented. But there's a high amount of net worth. Okay. And we were talking about the trust. And I said, you know, if I did a trust for you, I'm not, you know, there's a couple hundred grand I would put in it. And that's good to protect a couple hundred grand. Who doesn't want to protect a couple hundred thousand dollars? But however, your retirement wouldn't go in. And your retirement was, you know, almost about $1.5 million. And I said, just so you understand, when, if and when you needed long-term care, and then we applied for Medicaid, and of course we got you approved because, you know, your non-retirement money was protected, and now there's retirement that, that Medicaid has special rules for. I said, the amount of income that Medicaid is going to say you have down the road because of your Social Security, because of your pension, because of your distributions from your retirement that Medicaid requires you to take, and we'll talk in a second about how high those distributions may be, depending on your age. I said, the, if we did all of this and it worked, what does success look like? Success in your fact pattern, if you had long-term care needs and you're trusted what it's supposed to do, it would end up saving about $700 a month, maybe. And the reason why in that fact pattern was because based on age and based on the size of the retirement account, the distributions that Medicaid would require and consider as income would be so high, coupled with Social Security and pension, that he would almost be private paying for his long-term care needs. So in that instance, well, let's focus on avoiding probate. Let's focus on having the right kind of plan. Maybe we still do a trust, and maybe it's a revocable trust as opposed to a Medicaid trust. Maybe he still does the Medicaid trust, but at least we know that it's not like everything's going to be protected. And before people say, well, wait a minute, I can't believe they're going to go after the retirement like this, the percentage they end up taking, Jamarie, that they want as income may be relatively low, all things considered. I mean, there might be 93% of that retirement that is spared entirely, and it may be based on the market and based on whether or not countries are invading other countries or there's this or that going on in the world. Maybe the market goes up. And maybe the market goes up and appreciates more than the distribution that Medicaid wanted to begin with. So it was a very interesting fact pattern to me because we have a person with a high net worth. We have a person who listens and knows and believes in the trust and understands he wants to protect assets. However, because of the types of assets he has and because of the way Medicaid treats retirement, which I think is a great thing, to say how Medicaid treats retirement, because so much of the retirement is spared. This gentleman, his income would be so high, and so it wouldn't make sense. And I thought it's really important for people to understand that there are times when we maybe don't need to do a Medicaid trust for someone, and it may be because of the size of their retirement. Any thoughts?
Yeah, no, that's a really great point. It's important to look at both the income and the assets, and especially if you're single, because if you're single and you're in the nursing home, they take all of your income. And all of your income does equal, besides your Social Security and your pension, your distributions from the retirement account. And the distributions from the retirement account are normally calculated under the IRS tables. When you reach age 72, those are called your required minimum distributions. However, Medicaid has a different way of calculating them. They're called periodic payments, and they use a different table. And under that table, you're going to have to take out more than your required minimum distributions. So there are many cases where, you know, we could protect your assets, but looking at your income is so high that it's probably almost equal to the cost of the nursing home, as you said, so there's no savings.
Jamarie, I'm sorry, let me interject for a moment here, because people are going to say, well, wait a minute, you guys keep saying a nursing home is $15,000 a month, I know I don't make $15,000 a month, so I don't think it's going to be a problem. But I think the point that you brought up, which is so important, is that the IRS tables are different than the calculations that Medicaid makes. IRS is saying your minimum distribution. Medicaid wants you to maximize your distribution.
That's correct, and we've seen, just roughly speaking, some cases where it almost doubles the amount that you have to take out every month, right, for based on your age.
For most people, when they maximize their retirement, they're still going to get a wonderful, quote-unquote, deal when it comes to Medicaid, because maybe their maximized income is $6,000 or $7,000 a month, but that nursing home was $15,000 a month, so we still have a $9,000 shortfall every month, and that's why it's so important to protect the other assets. The other thing, though, and I know we're up against the break here, the final point I want to make about this fact pattern is, so then, you know, he was like almost disappointed, right? Because, well, you know, so I guess I can't protect the income at all. And I kind of turned it. No, wait a minute. Income is the greatest thing you could possibly have when you have long-term care needs, because it increases all your options, your ability, sir, to get care at home and in a fact pattern that will work, because your spend down income, which we could protect with a pooled income trust, which we always talk about, we could use all of that income to pay for home and to pay for more caregivers and to pay to bring the nursing home to you instead of figuring out ways to pay for you going to the nursing home. So it's a very good fact that he has a large retirement. It happens to be that he doesn't need a Medicaid trust, in my opinion, because of that income. But it also means that he's going to have a world of options if and when he does have long-term care needs. So, you know, it's in the wrong hands here. People may come up with the wrong conclusions, which is, I don't need to plan at all if I have retirement money, or it's not worth it to save for retirement because they're going to take it all. It's worth it to save for retirement. It's worth it to plan for not being here one day, and completely worth it to think about and plan for your long-term care needs.
We'll take our break right here. We'll be back with the second half of the Herzog Law Firm's Estate Medicaid Planning Hour coming up right after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for, options available for Medicaid planning, and more. With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany, West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs, Executive Woods in Clifton Park, and 130 North Front Street in Kingston, our attorneys are here to help you. If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David, Jane Marie, or Harry, please call us during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581. Our Saratoga Springs office, 518-581-8131. Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010. And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405. Let the Herzog Law Firm help navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Good morning. We're back. My name is Dave Kabikian. And
I'm Jane Marie Schaefer.
Hey, Jane Marie. If you weren't listening to the first half hour, we were talking about the use of a power of attorney and how it works with bank accounts and rights of survivorship, perhaps, with bank accounts, or is it a joint owner on a bank account for convenience purposes? And before and after that call, we were also talking about what Medicaid looks at as your resources and why it's so important to understand the interplay between retirement assets, which are not quote-unquote resources for purposes of Medicaid's resource calculations, and then what they consider as income. And, Jamie, this is why every fact pattern is so specific to each person, and it's not fair to say everyone needs this kind of trust or everyone needs that kind of trust. I would submit to you everyone needs a power of attorney. I'm pretty firm on that one. I think you are too. But I do think everyone needs to always come up with a plan and at least be assessed to understand their liability as well as the opportunities that their facts may give them.
I agree. You know, it's not off. I would say we do more, definitely more Medicaid trust than revocable trust, but there are going to be situations where the revocable trust is going to be the best option for you based on, you know, everyone's circumstances are different. And the other time that we do a revocable trust is when people are younger and not ready to do the irrevocable trust yet. And then when they get older, they're retiring, we can then convert it to an irrevocable trust. And I know you talk about that a lot, about how you could start off with one plan and then change it as you get older.
Absolutely. So you could be our next caller, 518-476-5900. But, Jamie, you, by bringing up revocable trust, you are bringing up the next rip from the headlines. Unaware, you didn't even know it. But rip from the headlines, actual client this week. And our caller in the first half hour had alluded to her sister who had long-term care insurance. The client I met with earlier this week, husband and wife, they came in with a, I think it was a John Hancock long-term care insurance policy, and I opened up the folders that they had, Jamie, and I saw that little box and emblem that says New York State Partnership Plan.
That's
so for
great.
For those that don't know, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead, Jamie.
No, I just said I'm always happy when I see that because you don't see many policies like that. And
exactly.
The reason it's so great is the New York State Partnership Policy is a special type of long-term care insurance that guarantees that you will be eligible for Medicaid when your policy runs out, regardless of how much assets that you have. So you have your long-term care insurance that will pay first when you're in the nursing home, you know, for usually 3 years or 5 years. And then after that three-year period is up, Medicaid will pay, and you don't have to go through the normal process of Medicaid looking at your assets or any transfers that you made. You just automatically become eligible for Medicaid.
Hey, Jamie, can you say that last part one more time so that sinks into everyone?
You automatically become eligible for Medicaid regardless of your assets or transfers.
What if I have $2 million?
You're eligible.
What if I have $2.4 million?
You're eligible.
It's unbelievable. So this policy, New York State Partnership, and they're really hard to come by these days, but when we see them, we get happy. It means that we don't need to plan as if tomorrow you needed a nursing home, we're in trouble. Now, this policy, and their premiums were pretty hefty, and the premiums I saw were as of 2009. So I can only imagine what they're paying now for this plan. But New York State and their partners with long-term care insurance dangle a little carrot in front of you. They say, you know what, you're going to pay this premium, and if you continue to reside in New York when you need your long-term care, which is an important feature of it, is the New York State Partnership Plan. As Jamie said, if you go through your benefits, if you exhausted the total amount of your policy, whether by duration, 3 years is what this policy was, or by an aggregate amount, perhaps, you're in good shape. Their daily benefit as of 2009 was $300 a day in a nursing home, and there's a little asterisk next to the 300 to indicate that it's going to be adjusted for inflation and go up over time. So I have no doubt that they're well over $400 at this point of a benefit. We talked about something called an elimination period, which is the amount of time when they can trigger their policy, but their policy isn't paying anything for them. And normally I see 90 days or 100 days as a period of time where you are on your own, even though you had insurance. This one was 30 days. I don't remember ever seeing 30. I know I've seen it once or twice, but like this was like finding a Mickey Mantle rookie card at a yard sale type of situation where this is an unbelievably valuable thing they have. And I said to them, the very first check you write every single year is going to be a check to this long-term care insurance provider to keep this policy intact. And so they didn't really understand what it meant for it to be a partnership plan. So I walked them through it, and they were so confused because they said, well, wait a minute. What about protecting our assets? I said, you are going to be qualified for Medicaid right after you run out of benefits. And they said, well, what's the catch? Well, there's a couple catches. Number one, you have to pay every year for it. And they are paying more than a Medicaid trust per year, Jamie. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
And done some. Catch number two, they moved to Florida. They don't have any connection in New York anymore. Well, the New York State Partnership Plan will not help them in terms of that post long-term care insurance period of time. They're not going to just roll into some Florida nursing home and say, see, I have a New York State Partnership Plan. Mm-hmm. So you kind of need to be tied to New York, not that that's a bad thing. That dangling of the carrot. Right. Oh, I got it 3 years, and then I'm good. Well, the average stay in a nursing home, Jane Marie, is not 3 years. It's less than 3 years. So not a lot of people get to the carrot part. But, man, is it nice to know that that carrot part is there. And a lot of times I talk about my parents, Jane Marie, and they have this policy. They have the New York State Partnership Plan. They have it adjusted for inflation. They are spending a lot of money every year, and they are doing it for my brother and I, and I'm honored that they're doing it. If Dave Kubikian in law school could have talked to my parents at that time, and knowing what I know now, I would probably have told them, well, let's just do some good old-fashioned trust planning so you don't have a premium every year. That's, you know, not a small premium. But it's one way to solve the puzzle. And so my parents and this client have solved the puzzle. They did it in a rather unique way. One of the things that a lot of people don't realize about that kind of policy is that even though you might be asset eligible for Medicaid and the five-year look-back period won't really matter at all, the income rules of Medicaid are still going to apply to the fact pattern. So if there's a lot of income, Medicaid's still going to want spend down. If there's a lot of retirement, they're still going to want you to maximize that retirement. Medicaid will still, in New York, take the income that is excess, but you are asset eligible. And I said, you know what, sir, ma'am, if you're going to want to do old-fashioned estate planning, meat and potatoes, who gets what, let's avoid probate, let's stay safe out there, but we're not worried about long-term care. I said, we could do a revocable trust, and off you go. And so I felt great about them. I was very happy for them because of that policy. And what was striking to me is that they had no idea what it all meant. And so some time ago in 2009, like 13 years ago, they made a decision that was obviously cost a lot of money over the years, but is also going to protect a lot of money if they do have long-term care needs down the road.
Right. No, they made a great decision, and that policy, it's really unique. It's great to have that policy. The other benefit I like of long-term care insurance policies is that it pays for assisted living. So, the Medicaid pays for home care. Medicaid pays for nursing homes. But there are very few assisted living facilities that are covered by Medicaid. So I have seen many people, not just with the New York State Partnership, but with any other type of long-term care insurance policy, use that money to pay for their assisted living costs. And that could be worth its money just to have that cost covered, because assisted living is not cheap, especially if you need a lot of help or if you're in a memory care assisted living facility. And long-term care insurance can really make the difference between being able to stay in assisted living or having to go to a nursing home.
It kind of goes back to that statement I made right before the half hour, which is, income is always a good thing, and it gives you options. And that long-term care insurance, if you have it and it's, going to cover enough, it's basically income. It's like you're getting income to now pay for that assisted living, and it gives you that option. We've had, unfortunately, fact patterns where we're able, and we talked actually in the last couple of weeks about it, where we kind of can point to the month and date, the month and day even, that someone is going to run out of money when it comes to their holdings, and they're going to have no choice but to need a nursing home if they have those long-term care needs. They're not going to have the ability to private pay assisted living in certain fact patterns. So, you know, we don't really care how you plan. Honestly, we don't. But we just want you to plan and not act like, well, I don't need to worry about it, or, well, my kids will take care of me. Well, I sure hope they will, but it would be nice if you had, you know, the ability to qualify for Medicaid and have Medicaid pay them as well, which gets me to the third rip from the headline. Real client came in for her mother. It's actually mother, so daughter and granddaughter came in for mom. Okay. And they said to me, well, you know, we went and talked to someone, and then we talked to like an HR, not an HR person, but an administrator at the hospital. And they said, oh, no, your mother makes too much money to qualify for Medicaid. And immediately I just shook my head and said, there's no such thing as making too much money to qualify for Medicaid. So would you not, you didn't know this was ripped from the headline, but do you mind telling everyone why you can never make too much money to qualify for Medicaid?
Yeah, that's, I agree. There's no top limit on the income that you can make for Medicaid.
Exactly.
Right? So, you know, there's, if you make too much money and you're over the allowable limit, you have something called a spend down. And this is talking about community Medicaid. Nursing home's different. But at least in the community, you can do a couple different things with your spend down. But just because you have a spend down doesn't mean you don't qualify for Medicaid. With a spend down, you could use it to pay extra medical bills. You could use your spend down. Medicaid would happily take your spend down and then give you services. But the most common option that we do is to take your spend down. Remember, spend down is the excess income, and put it into a pooled trust. And when you put it into a pooled trust, you still have use of that money. So you got the benefits of qualifying for Medicaid and having full use of that extra income. So there really isn't any way where your income could be too high to qualify.
Well, Jamie, I think you said earlier, nursing homes, you know, Medicaid and nursing home situations, you're keeping $50 a month of your income. Everyone makes more than $50 a month of income with Social Security, right? But people qualify for Medicaid because that's how the spend down works. At home, it's $954, I believe you can keep.
Yep.
And if your income's higher, and you didn't say anything, you know what? I didn't want to mess with this pool trust that it's I'm confused. You keep your $954. You give up whatever else you have, and you're qualified for the program. And there's like a sports analogy here. You're a Patriots fan, right, Jamie?
Yes.
Yeah.
I know. So,
what's that?
I know it bugs you, but yes.
Oh, I'm a 49er fan. We're okay. We can coexist.
Okay.
By the way, I think Tom Brady's going to go to the 49ers, and that's what I heard. Anyway. In football, right, the NFL, they have a salary cap. Their salary cap is known as a hard salary cap. If they cannot pay salaries to their players above the cap. It's a hard cap. You can't go over. That's it. Okay? In baseball, or basketball, rather, is maybe a better example. They have a soft cap, right? They have an amount where they want you to stay under that amount, but if you're over, there's a luxury tax, they call it. It's kind of like a spend down of sorts. So any team in the NBA could make their payroll $400 million if they wanted to, but they're going to pay a absolutely punitive amount of tax the way that the salary caps work. What's the point of all this? When it comes to assets and Medicaid, it's a hard cap. That's why we need to plan 5 years ahead of time. There's no pool trust for the assets. You either have too much or you don't have too much. End of story. You qualify or you don't qualify. When it comes to the soft cap, when it comes to income, you have a spend down. So you could do, you know, you could have 10. Look, the client that we talked about before with the $1.5 million retirement, he's got a lot of income, Jamie. He can qualify for home care because the income is all right. It's a soft cap. And for, you know, anyone out there who is not a future client, perhaps, but is someone who is, someone who talks to families that are dealing with long-term care situations or is a care coordinator in a hospital, you got to understand, you can never say to someone you make too much money to qualify. You could say you have too much money to qualify, but it's never you make too much money to qualify. And when it comes to home care, we talk about this all the time. You say it every single time we're on the radio, Jerry. There's no look-back period for the home care. So even if you have too much money, you can qualify for home care by creating a trust. The next month you're going to qualify for home care financially. You can get under the hard cap 1 month ahead of time. Nursing home care, you got to be 5 years ahead of time. So it just frustrates me to no end when we are spending so much of our valuable consultation time with clients basically reprogramming all the bad information that they got from somebody else.
I know. I mean, that's some misinformation. I've heard that too, that clients come in and say, I make too much money to qualify for Medicaid. It just doesn't make sense. You know, so I was talking about the community limits, but if you're in the nursing home, you're going to qualify for Medicaid. They're just going to take all of your income over $50. If you have a spouse, there's a community spouse allowance that they are allowed to have. But you'll qualify for Medicaid. I mean, I think the only time I could think of where it would be, it's not that you wouldn't qualify, but that it wouldn't be to your advantage, is that if your income is equal to or more than a private pay nursing home, right?
Right.
But that doesn't happen often. That's $15,000 a month.
Well, so, Jamie, in my fact pattern that I was dealing with, mom's retirement money was $3,300 a month.
And oh, my God.
For someone like that, could you imagine how valuable it is for Medicaid to be able to help pay for home care for that woman? So she could preserve her $3,300 a month to pay for bills and pay for taxes and insurance and utilities, you know, to deal with our winters. You know, she's going to have a $400 energy bill this month. You know, so for people to say, well, Medicaid's not an option, you know, basically the way the conversation started was, well, we hope that Medicaid would have been part of it, but we were told she makes too much money. I was like, is she a Rockefeller? Because she doesn't make too much money. There's no way.
Right.
So the last rip from the headline one, we got about 10 minutes left. We have enough time for a call, 518-465-5900. 476-5900. I always mix up our numbers.
Mixing up our numbers.
516-5900. So the last one, Jamie, is a similar story where someone gets some bad advice. And this one gets a little technical, and I'm not going to get too into it, but I just want everyone out there to understand it's complicated and there's always opportunities. It's not just black and white. Nothing in our area law is black and white. So it was about mom. Mom's not doing so hot. Mom is likely going to need Medicaid, and it may be that the Medicaid she needs is in a nursing home. She did a life estate deed on her property many, many years ago, which means that property is going to avoid probate, and that property, for purposes of Medicaid, is protected. It was a deed from her to her kids with a reserved ability to stay in the house. We don't always like that, but when it works, it works. We're happy about it when it works. And in that instance, we're good as long as the house doesn't sell. Now, she's got some money. She got about $150,000 or so. And the reason why she doesn't have more money than that, Jamie, is because over her lifetime, she's made it a habit to take care of her kids and her grandkids every which way she can. So she gifts. She gifts during Christmas time. She gifts during your birthday, above and beyond what maybe we would be gifting to our kids. So a couple thousand bucks, thousands here, thousands there. In opportune times to help her family. And the diagnosis for dementia was fairly recently for her. And big picture, her health is otherwise good. And he the gentleman I spoke to, his son, said, you know, we went to an attorney and he said, don't touch any more of her money. Don't allow her to gift anything. Don't do anything because five-year look back. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, well, that certainly is not wrong. There is a five-year look back period and we don't want to willy-nilly tell people to make transfers that are in violation or will come up during that five-year look back period. But I said, tell me about your mom. How long has she been gifted for? What kind of gifts did she do? How often? If you added up all the gifts every year, what do you think it would be? If she was going to gift some money tomorrow or next Christmas, would it be in line with what she's been doing before? And the reason why is because there's an exception to the transfer rule when it comes to the five-year look-back period. One of the exemptions happens to be gifts that were made that were not in contemplation of needing a nursing home. If you were okay, if life was good, you had not a care in the world and you just wanted to help pay for your granddaughter's wedding and you made a gift, that doesn't necessarily count against you. And more importantly, if you have a pattern of every year gifting a certain amount, not only could those gifts be exempt from the five-year look-back period, but future gifts may also be exempt because you're just following a pattern you have established. And we had a really long conversation about this, and I don't know. I don't know if we'll, you know, give the green light on more gifting. I don't know if they will end up gifting more. I know that the mom wants to, and she still has her capacity. And I said to them, I think life is really important, too, and if she wants to see her grandkids enjoy some money, she should give. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, by the way, if 4 years from now she needs a nursing home, mm-hmm. Jamie would do a loan and gift plan to protect half of that, of the 150 grand she's got. And mm-hmm. the way that would work is that you would advise the client to gift 75 grand of it, roughly half of it as part of that plan. I said, if that comes to be, well, we could say the gifts that were made in 2022 or the gifts that were made in 2023 are part of that gift, part of the gift and loan plan. Oh, by the way, we could do a fair hearing. And maybe would win. And this client said, the other attorney said none of these things. And does the other attorney just do elder law? And he said, no. And that's the fourth lesson from the headlines. The devil's in the details, everybody. We say it every week. And we have to because you forget. If an attorney says, oh, no, you can't do this. Well, do they specialize in this area of law? Are they sure? We've done fair hearings where we've won. We've done fair hearings where we've lost, all about this fact pattern or these kinds of fact patterns. And, you know, life is really important. I would like that woman to be able to gift to her grandkids. I don't think she has to stop. You know, it's bad enough she's got this diagnosis. Does she need to now stop everything she enjoyed doing because of it? I don't think so.
I really like what you said that, I mean, yeah, one thought is we could go to fair hearing and argue that these were gifts not in contemplation of going to a nursing home, but then we have a fallback pattern, right? So if that doesn't work, we could do what we call a rule of halves transfer, and, you know, we could offset the gifts that she made by giving away her money with a promissory note, but you're not gonna, as you say, you're not going to hear any of these options unless you go to an elder law attorney who specializes in this, and also an elder law attorney who's, you know, willing to think outside the box and try different options. You and I have both been to fair hearings. We've both argued this exception to the rule, right, that gifting was just normal and was part of a pattern. So, you know, we can give clients many different options, right? We're not going to tell them it's just one way or, you know, Don't make any gifts. It's just not allowed. No, it's more complex than that.
It's all gray area. There is no black or white on it. And right. So, you know, what else could we advise? Well, if we said to the son, okay, here's the deal. Let's prepare a Medicaid trust right now. Let's throw the money into the trust, and let's cross our fingers. Well, that obviously is a transfer, and if we didn't get through the 5 years, it's a big transfer, and we'll have to undo it and do this gift of halves, as you were mentioning. If they do incremental gifts, as they've always been doing, well, yeah, the worst case is that it's part of the look back, and we do the rule of halves. That is the worst case, is we're no worse off. Best case is there's more money in accordance with this woman's pattern of gifting that will have been moved to her loved ones who get to say thank you to her face. She gets to pay for, you know, a grandson's college tuition, perhaps, and get the joy out of that. And I think maybe sometimes we should focus more on these kinds of things, but the goal is not saving every dollar. It is not. The goal is to make it take best advantage of the rules and your fact pattern, your wishes and your desires and all that stuff, because the goal isn't to save every dollar. You don't want to live that way. I don't want to live that way. No one wants to live to save every dollar, because then you're at the $16,800 threshold going forward, right, Jamie? Just to make sure that we're always below. You don't want to do that, right? Enjoy. But within enjoying, you know, get the proper counsel and make educated decisions on stuff.
Yes, that's true. It isn't always about saving the money or, you know, the Medicaid planning. It's combined with what your overall goals are. I mean, occasionally we'll have people, rarely, who say, I don't care about saving any of my money, so I'm not really interested in a Medicaid trust. I mean, more typically those are without children or something like that. But
I wish we had more time, because that would be a fifth rip from the headline. We get that all the time, which is, I don't care what happens to my money. That's a proper answer. There's nothing wrong with that answer. By the way, Ben, we need to work on getting that Law and Order dun-dun in the future. Right. Is that possible?
We'll start working on that this week for you.
Okay. I assume that we probably have to pay some money for it.
I'll give you the stock lawyer answer. Maybe.
No.
It depends.
Have a good weekend, guys.
Have a good weekend. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.